Normal, traditional freshman year.
Normal freshman
what
year.
What does that mean?
Had Professor Royston for calculus on Saturday morning. I think Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. Didn't understand a thing he said. Just like any other freshman. I had no clue. I loved him and figured out the way I'm going to pass this course is talk about baseball with him because he went to the University of Michigan, I think, and played baseball. So I just learned about baseball and I talked baseball with him. And he liked me and I passed. I crammed, studied, and made a C. Literally walked out the door. It was kind of a core dump, and I put everything I knew about calculus on a piece of paper, which obviously was enough to give me a C, and was happy as I could be. English had done, I did fairly well in biology and did well in English, clearly did well in history, I believe. Can't remember what else I took. I took Spanish, I took French, and I think I had Professor Hamer, maybe. Didn't particularly like French. They hated language lab. You know, always said if I ever go to France, I'll be financially well off enough to hire somebody who can speak English. So I don't care. So I didn't do quite as well in French as everything, but I did manage to pull the magic 2.0000 grade point average. My first semester, which was the cutoff for getting initiated into your fraternity. So in the first semester, got initiated into ZBT, and just the rest of the year, just like I say, had that traditional first year. Think it may have been the spring of my freshman year or the fall of my sophomore year. When Melvin Van Peebles came to town, we had a world premiere of a movie here, Watermelon Man, 1969, 1970 maybe. And at the time, being one of only two black students on campus, I was assigned to escort Mr. Van Peebles, and that clearly was quite a thrill for me. One of my fraternity brothers, Steve Maslansky's family, had some ownership interest in Columbia. And we had a film festival here. Professor Riegel over in the journalism department, I believe Ritz Riegel, one of the two, had a film festival. And I managed to, they managed to get Watermelon Man world premiered here. And Melvin Van Peebles showed up as the director. So I spent 3 days with him, two and a half days hosting him, kind of. We spent almost that entire time shooting pool over in the general's headquarters of the cockpit, as we called it at the time. And, drinking wine and talking. I mean, fascinating, just fascinating person. And, to have a world premiere of a movie in Lexington at the State Theater was quite the deal. And I remember thinking, this is about as good as it gets. That was kind of the beginning of, right about that period was the beginning of the end of the Age of Innocence. Because right about that time, things were beginning to happen politically in the larger world and were beginning to happen on campus, and things were becoming more and more active and more aggressive in terms of positions being taken and stands being taken on some significant issues. And things began to change right about that time. So right about 1969, people started attending protest meetings in Washington. We went away from things like wearing coat and tie, and the dress code loosened up, and all of a sudden we had guys who were sporting long hair. Real long hair.
What happened then?
I don't.
Did the faculty go nuts when people stopped wearing coats and ties?
The faculty didn't so much go nuts. There were some who were very traditional, old traditionalists like Professor Futch, who just kind of said, I don't care what the university says, you come in my class, you're going to wear a coat and tie. Pure and simple. Others at the time, it really all depended, because we had some faculty members who were what I'd call hip, or wanting to be hip, who, that's cool. Well, I can understand. You know how professors, whatever it takes to relate to your students, that's what you do. So they tried to relate by being friends. And we said, hey, no problem. That's cool. You can do that. But there was not a real, at least among, the, if there was a real hue and cry when that change happened, the students didn't perceive it so much. I mean, there may have been some great consternation among the administration and faculty, but, you know, we really just didn't see, you know, guys just kind of going, oh, my.
Did it happen school-wide, or was it the freshmen and sophomores who were doing it and the seniors were still wearing coats and ties, or did everybody change simultaneously?
Well, it everybody changed, but I wouldn't say simultaneously. It really took hold among the younger guys in the freshman and sophomore classes. And the older guys would loosen up to the extent that they would wear a sport coat with no tie and maybe some penny loafers with no socks. That's kind of one extreme, and then there'd be the, you know, the bell-bottom, tie-dye, t-shirt, long-haired hippie on the other extreme. So we had the continuum. And by the time I was a senior, my class basically had a bunch of, you know, bell-bottom wearing, tie-dye, long-haired hippie freaks, and the guys who were coming behind us were beginning to rotate back into something of a bit more traditional style. So, you know, we kind of went through the continuum while I was here, you know, and I was kind of at the beginning, at the end, beginning and the end of it during that period of time, and it just kind of went full circle. Not back all the way back, of course, to, you know, wearing coats and ties and being very conservative, but at least to being somewhat more, you know, more casual in terms of dress down, you know, going back to maybe a sport coat and some chinos or whatever. But yeah, it was an interesting time, and to have been here during that time, in my particular circumstance, was just, I mean, you just can't begin to describe it. It was phenomenal. It was phenomenal. And when we had a questionnaire on our alumni form that asked, please name your most memorable experience, my simple comment was, I had more memorable experiences than I can ever begin to recount, and I can't name just one. I cannot name just one experience that I consider most memorable. There's just too many. I mean, it could be any one of 100. 200. I mean, if I could recall, you know, the things I did 25, 26, 27 years ago with perfect clarity, there'd be just so many things that I just say, yeah, I can't even, yeah, I don't even want to begin to get into it, because they're just these little flashes of things that come back, and I look back on them finally, and I think, man, those were the days, you know, those were the days. Never to come again, but those were the days.
Now, one thing you have not mentioned, and it fascinates me, is the one thing that people say when they talk about you and Linwood, they say you lived at home.
I lived at home for my freshman year. Sophomore year, I lived in the fraternity house.
Oh, you did?
Sure. Yeah, I lived in the ZBT house my sophomore year.
See, there are rumors about you that aren't true.
Yeah, my sophomore year, I lived in the ZBT house, which is now the Kappa Sig house. I lived in the room right at the top of the steps, to the left. Yeah, I lived in the ZBT house my sophomore year. And my junior and senior years, I lived a little bit of everywhere. I stayed at the fraternity house some, but mostly I became kind of an ad hoc dorm counselor. Because in my junior year, they put most of the black students, they were over in, I think in Gaines or wherever. So I wound up spending half my time, or a significant portion of my time, camped out over there trying to keep those guys going. And then in my senior year, they moved a good number of them up to the Preston House, which is the house right at the head of Preston Street up by in front of the post office. Mm-hmm. I lived at the Preston House. Now, the university may not know I lived there, but I basically had my cotton and all my stuff at the Preston House, and that's where I lived. So, yeah, I went home. My mom would feed me every now and then, but I really didn't live at home for 3 years.
All right, I'm glad to get that record straight. I'm glad to get that record straight.
Yeah, I like I say, and my mom would cook for me, do my laundry maybe, but I pretty much left at the end of my freshman year, and that was it.
How did your parents feel about the whole getting involved in Washington Emily and being here? And
well, they loved the idea that I stayed at home. They absolutely loved the idea I stayed at home. They loved the idea that I went to Washington and Lee. They were clearly a lot less enthused about my getting as involved in some of the things I got involved in as I did. You know, like every parent, get a haircut. Like every parent, why don't you wear some decent clothes? Like every parent, you know, what are you doing off up in Washington protesting? Stay your tail down here and get your education, blah, blah, blah. You know, typical parent-child relationship. I loved them to death, and they loved me to death, and they were as proud as they could be, and you know, I tried never to do anything to hurt them. And then that, you know, pretty much is it for them. I mean, they frankly loved the idea that I was at home. Yeah, they didn't want to see me go off to school somewhere if I could help it, and they didn't particularly feel strongly one way or the other about, and I don't even think they were cognizant of the fact that I was in respects a pioneer and was exposing myself to what I may be exposing myself to. I don't think they consciously thought about it, because I think they perceived that they had prepared me well enough that I could deal with anything, so it didn't make any difference. And, you know, they kind of suggest, or without saying it, they pretty much knew that, look, you know, you got enough sense to act right, and if you don't, you know, we'll knock you out. So that was kind of it.
Okay, now, you talked about when the guys arrived in 1970, and then there were some more who followed them in 71.
Not nearly as strong as the ones in 1970. Not nearly as strong. I've never been able to prove this, but I know I've had some discussions with members of the class of 1970 that are my compatriots and close personal friends, but I made a comment to them that it is my firm belief that the university made a conscious decision in its admissions policy to never again make the mistake of going out and accepting a bunch of guys like you. Because you can cause a man's hair to go gray real easily. And whether or not that was the case, I don't know, but you just knew that if there had been a real aggressive effort to get that class of 1970 in here, get, you know, that number of bodies, and I don't think we've ever approached that number of bodies again, that effort changed from that point on, and you know, they'd come in at, you know, 4, 5, 6. He had a good class, maybe 8 people would show up following that time. But there never was this concerted effort to go out and get a big old bunch of guys like the group that came in here in 1970.
Who was behind that effort? Do you know?
I have no idea. And as I say, once again, I can't even prove that it was a conscious policy. But I remember going to meetings up with Dean John and Dean Farah, both men who were close to me and I was close to when I was here, and have maintained the relationship with Dean John even to this day. But I remember how exasperated they would get sometimes dealing with us. It would be like, I don't believe it, you know. What do we have to do to get these guys to act right, quote, whatever right may be? We had one incident in which it was my senior year. Thomas Penn was walking his girlfriend, maybe soon to be fiance, back up to the Preston House. And we had some townies, probably some guys from Buena Vista, is my recollection. Drove by and pulled a shotgun on them, and he had to push his date into the grass up just above the post office. Many of these guys drive off, of course. Well, we take this pretty seriously. You know, to us, that is absolutely an outright, upfront assault on us. It's like, okay, now, one of several things is going to happen. Either the university is going to figure out a way to deal with this problem, or we're going to deal with this problem, and we know how to deal with it. Take our word for it. We know how to deal with it. We had a meeting up at, I believe, Dean John's house, up on Jackson Avenue, someone's house on Jackson Avenue. I think it was Dean John's house. And I remember Dean John or someone making the comment that 9 times out of 10, if someone pulls a gun on you, they won't shoot you. And, you know, Hill and Buck and Hutchison and myself, we all just kind of look at each other, you know. And I go, wait a minute, excuse me, but where you come from, maybe they don't shoot. Where we come from, when people pull guns on you, they shoot you. Just pure and simple. And at that time, I made the statement that if the police of Lexington and the university security and the state police or whoever you have, cannot protect us, we'll protect ourselves. We don't need anybody to take care of us. I mean, if you want a shooting war, then you got a shooting war. Pure, it's just simple as that. We will not tolerate having guns pulled on us. And so the least thing you can do is go out and inform everybody that from now on, if you pull a gun on one of these guys, they're going to pull a gun back on you and they're going to shoot you. Just pure and simple. That's all it is to it. There's no discussion. And probably 5 people armed themselves almost immediately after that meeting, or within several days after that meeting. And I mean, really, when I say armed themselves, I don't mean with BB guns. I mean just flat-out weapons. And it was like, I assume people knew it. I don't know if they knew it or not, but we were very serious. We were not going to be terrorized. And it was just pure and simple. It's like, look, if somebody thinks it's a game to pull a gun on you, then we'll have to show them that there is a very serious kind of consequence when you do that. We had not many conflicts with locals. Most of the locals were pretty cool. Every now and then we get a couple guys who get drunk up and act stupid. But Murph, bless his heart, Murph did a great job of diffusing almost every situation. He did a great job of diffusing almost every situation that had the potential to get truly out of hand and have somebody get hurt bad. And we never had any situations in which someone got what I call hurt real bad. And that was just by sheer providence and a couple good people.
Murph seems to have been a real presence on this campus.
Mm-hmm, so, he was.
So he was real important to you all, too?
He was important to us. And Murph was cool. Murph understood us. You know, he just kind of, he watched out for us. He knew what was going on. He pretty much knew what was going on. And, you know, he didn't let too many things happen to us. And if somebody was going to come, especially somebody from outside the university, he was especially aware of local presence and how it might interact with us in a negative way. So he managed to keep that to a minimum. We were quite fortunate to have someone like Murph at that particular point in time. And we were pretty close to him. In fact, I talked to him today at lunch. I went right up to him. I would talk to him before I talked to President Hunt. When I went, hey, Murph, how you doing, bud? I mean, we went back immediately 25 years ago and started talking about stuff. So, yeah, he was clearly a presence. But he either diffused situations before they happened or buffered us by keeping certain elements away from the campus that could have made things a bit dicier around here than they really were. So that's to his credit. He may not get credit for that, but you know, at that time there were a couple people around here who had both the means and the capacity to wreak pretty serious devastation on someone if they wanted to. And we never had to do that. But like, once again, I go back and say, I give him as much credit as I give anyone. He did good work. He did good work. You know, and him being an honorary alumnus, he deserves, if anyone in my, experience with the university deserves to be an honorary alumnus of this institution. Murph is it. You know, he served his time and he did good. The 4 years I was here with him, he did good. He protected a lot of stuff.
Yeah, he sure sounds like a very special person. How about the honor system? What did it mean to you?
Well, you know, it's interesting you would ask that question, especially in light of the discussions we've had over the past several days at the alumni board level. When I came here, the honor system, of course, was presented in the orientation at freshman camp, and at several other, you know, times during the course of the year. You know, you had the blue book, you know, I have neither given nor received aid on this exam or whatever it said at the time. It was not held out at that time, at least in my perception, as a threat the way it seems to be perceived now by the students. What it was, and I still haven't quite figured this out, because I talked about this a little bit yesterday, and I haven't figured this out. It was done so subtly. The indoctrination was done so subtly of the honor code, and not only the honor code, but this system of values that was inculcated by this place and instilled in me. And I don't know how it happened. And I didn't always exhibit it maybe when I was here, but as I've gotten on in life, I find these things beginning to come out, and I'm going, damn, I know where I learned that. I remember the situation that made me think and react this way. It became a system of values that you get in terms of how you deal in certain situations. And, you know, to this day, some of the things that came down from the honor system, and really what I'll call more than the honor system, the value system, play just fundamental roles in my everyday life. And I, as I say, I don't know yet how they did that to me. I don't know. I don't know who did it, how it was done, when it was done. All I know is that it was done, because I go through stuff now and I look back, and if I have to point to a factor in my life outside of the fact that my parents, as they say, brought me up basically right, the only other frame of reference I have for that value framework is the time that I spent here. Commitment to duty, perseverance, you know, ability to suffer in silence when you need to, when you know you're right. You know, it's that whole thing. The ability to speak out when you have to speak out to address an injustice. I mean, it's like, gosh, I don't know quite where it came from, but it came. So to me, the honor system really goes way beyond just that. You know, that statement of, you know, shall not lie, cheat, or steal, really kind of is this broader set of values, of which the honor system is clearly a linchpin, but it's, you know, it's clearly only one of several values that I kind of came out of this place with. And that's really kind of what it means to me. We talked about that a bit today, and I told them, you know, I made the comment yesterday when I was talking to Dallas Hagwood and Jed Dunn about the dilemma as we've gotten on in the world, the dilemma of being what I call an honorable man in a dishonorable world. Not everybody has that same value reference, or, you know, that framework of values that you come out of here with. So either you open yourself up to being had often, or you change your value framework, or you adapt your value framework, and it just becomes sometimes difficult to translate your values to those around you. And, you know, it's how you do it. And those are issues that we have to struggle with every day, because I know what may be right or wrong, and I've got to respond according to what makes me at peace with myself. But that's not always what makes my wife and my kids happiest, or is it always what makes my clients happiest, or whatever. So you go, you know, how do I deal with that? You deal with it. And that's how, like I said, I just deal with it and go and go to sleep. You know, I do what I got to do and say, okay, I did it, I'm out of here.
All right, you're talking about present day stuff. Do you recruit for WNL now?
I have not recruited for WNL actively outside of my chapter functions and chapter participation. And one of the reasons is I was active in the alumni admissions program when I lived in the Baltimore, actually when I lived in Annapolis. I moved to Dallas and 12 years ago and really got more off into big time civic stuff in Dallas. Was active in the chapter to an extent, but we had AAP people in Dallas. So I never really spent much time, you know, doing AAP related work. And clearly now that we just moved to North Carolina, I've not even been involved in any chapter related work. Alumni board related work, of course, but not recruitment directly. Anytime I have a chance to talk about the institution to a prospective student, I do. I have two children who I wasn't able to recruit to come here. A daughter who graduated from Rice in 1992 and a son who's currently a freshman up at St. John's. Both incredibly fine, unique institutions in their own right, but that their choices were best for them. And you know, they were real familiar with this place, and I didn't push one way or the other. I didn't say, look, this is where you need to be, because if they weren't going to be happy here. And you know, sometimes legacies have troubles following in dad's or mom's footsteps. They just don't want to have to go through that grief of being compared to. Mm-hmm. God, I remember your daddy, and you're just like my son said, I don't want to go through that.
I don't want to listen to that.
Yeah, you know, I got to deal with that enough every day. So it didn't bother me that he made a choice to go elsewhere.
I know you've had a long day, but I do have one more question I really want to ask you. Okay. Were there any faculty who made a particular difference for you?
Oh, several. I indicated my Eddie V. Axe Atwood, Dr. Labern.
Tell me about them. Tell me why they were important to you.
Well, Dr. Labern, I'll go with him first. He was, to me, the absolute epitome. And I was talking about this with someone today. He is the epitome of the Renaissance man. He was a man who was, and at the time one began to, you know, you kind of wondered about it, but as you got older, you really appreciated he was at peace with himself. He was sure of himself. He was very good at what he did. I don't think he ever stopped learning. I mean, he just had this incredible knowledge of this incredible range of subjects, and it just would boggle your mind when you talk to this guy. And his ability to just go to the heart of an issue, and he just cut through all the fog and haze and take the chaos and just cut through all the chaos and pick out the essential core of it and make sense out of it. And you'd sit there and you go, man, whew, this guy's good. This guy is real good. There was just something about him and his style that I think every student who ever had him had a little bit of him rub off on them. If all of us had our druthers, I mean, you know, the material world that we all go out in and struggle in to survive and do everything, that would be fine and dandy to succeed in that context, but to be able to be like a laborer, sure of yourself, confident in your abilities, you know, a man who has just so much style going for you, that's what a lot of us like to be. Atwood, because Atwood was my faculty advisor. He was a guy who kind of held me together there for a while. I had taken my, I wanted to be an economics major, and I had a professor, Nowak, and Nowak had the same exam every year. This was my sophomore year, Economics 101. He taught, Samuelson was the textbook, but he taught Keynesian, the Keynesian model. That was basically his stick. And everybody knew what the exam was. I mean, it was the same exam every year. absolutely the same exam every year. Didn't make a lick of difference. I mean, it was the same question. So everybody studied the Keynesian model and went in and took the exam, and your ability to explain it was, you know, your grade. I basically went to the ZBT house and got the guys there who were economics majors who were just incredible economists. One is a professor of economics at the University of Virginia now. They just drilled me to no end on Keynesian economics. I knew it up one side and down the other, knew what the question was going to be, went in, took the exam, exactly the same question that I knew was going to be on it, and got the exam back and had a D on it. And I was absolutely crushed, absolutely crushed. That was for the first time in my life, for the first time in a long time, I was just, not only was I crushed, but I was mad. I was really mad. I mean, I was shaking mad. It's like, what just happened here? So I go to Professor Nowak and I say, you know, can you explain this? And his comment, I'll never forget, was, isn't it obvious? I thought to myself, I think I'll go outside and sit down, because if I don't, I think I'm going to do something that you will regret, not me, but you will regret. So I went outside and sat down and kind of calmed down a little bit and, you know, kind of walked a little bit and cried to myself because I was so angry. So it had to release it somehow, because I was, you know, at that time I was about ready to just physically rip someone apart. And I was a pretty stout fellow. I mean, I, if you had better things to do, you'd pretty much go do them instead of mess with me. And I called my mother and she called my sister. My sister came and got me, took me out of town. It concerned my mother enough to think this boy's going to do something stupid. So she got me out of town, took me to Bedford for a day or two, and I came back, and I went in and talked to Professor Atwood, and he said, look, you know, really there's nothing that we can do simply because, you know, it's his discretion, but, you know, he so much as said without saying it, I know what happened. And just the style that he handled that situation with, to calm me down and kind of make me know that, yeah, okay, you can work your way through this one. And being my faculty advisor at the same time just kind of helped me. It just kind of kept me going, and I was always grateful for that. I was always grateful for that because that was my sophomore year, as I say. That was before I had another base of support in the guys that came in. And I really kind of, for the first time, felt truly alone. And I was hurt. I mean, it bothered me. It truly bothered me. And I look back to this day, if it hadn't been for my mother doing what she did, I frankly think I could have done something really, really violent, because I was mad. I was just mad. I mean, I was 18 years old and I was hurt and I was mad. And I didn't get mad much, but when I get mad, I do get real mad. And I was real mad. I mean, all rational logic, all that good stuff had kind of gone off out the window, because when I get an answer that says, isn't it obvious? And the only thing I can think of that is obvious is the fact that I don't look like this guy who happened to be a graduate of LSU. I'm thinking to myself, now wait a minute. I mean, we can't go through this paper and you can't tell me factually what is wrong, because basically that's the Keynesian model. I mean, my Keynesian model is just like everybody else. It's like 1 + 1 = 2. Mine is wrong, but his is right. Can't be. So something was amiss. And it was an interesting week. Let's put it that way. It was an interesting week in the life of Walter Blake, possibly an interesting week in the life of the institution if my mom had gotten me out of town, because I really don't know what I would have done. I mean, I know I was just kind of sitting there thinking, well, life as I know it is over, because at that point in life, you know, you're thinking, you know, I want to be an economics major, and my chance is gone because I've made a D in the core course. I mean, the base course. I mean, what chance do I have? Well, I took Dr. Atwood's course in money and banking and did quite well, and, you know, other economics courses and did well, and it's like, well, obviously I must have known a little something. But yeah, those are the two that that particularly stand out. And there were others, you know, but those two guys, those are the two that I would put on the list. And I think you'd find those two guys on a lot of lists.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I think you'd find those two guys on a lot of lists.
Well, I have a number of other things I'd love to talk to you about, but I know there's a party going on out there.
Yeah.
You've earned your place at the party.
And I put that on tape. I need a drink.
Walter, I want to thank you. This has been a real joy and a pleasure. Waiting for.
I enjoyed it, and I don't know what your time frame is on finishing this, but if you want to do it some more, we'll accommodate you.
I would love to, because there's several other important issues I'd like to talk to you about.
Okay, let's plan on doing it.
All right, thank you.